Although some of my nocturnal visitors made my heart beat fast, the roaring of the lions in the stillness of the night never seemed to me a blood-curdling noise, but a most wonderful sound, and often appealingly gentle. Every day we met many lions, but there was never any trace of our cubs. We now searched as close as we could to the hills, on the far side of the river. The dry season had come, and the animals were dependent on waterholes and rivers that did not dry up. This was the time of year when poachers' activities were at their height. Since they knew exactly where the animals must pass to quench their thirst, the wardens worked very hard to counteract their activities, and it was horrifying to see the number of snares, poisoned arrows and spears which they confiscated, and to realise how small a proportion of the total of weapons and traps these represented. All over East Africa, poaching, drought, floods, and the legal destruction of wild animals to make place for men and their crops threaten the survival of wildlife. The idea that they may one day become extinct appalls me. As the days passed in fruitless search, I became more and more depressed, and finally wrote to George asking him to come back and help me to find the cubs. A few days later, the director and a park warden visited my camp. I asked to be allowed to spend a few nights out in the car, in the hope that the cubs would be attracted by the headlights. I stressed again the condition of Jesper's wound and the youth of the cubs. The director replied that at the trustees' next meeting, he would put my requests before them. Meanwhile, he suggested that I should write to the chairman. This I did. On the 1st of July, I received a telegram from George, saying that he would arrive on the 4th of July. Meanwhile, I was searching. One evening on my way home, I was stopped by a safari party who told me that the night before, a pair of lions had passed within a few yards of their tent and that one of them was limping. On my return, I found George in camp. He gave me the director's reply to our appeal to the trustees, asking for permission to sleep out. The letter from the director stated that if we agreed to certain conditions, we could sleep out for not more than 7 nights, offer the cubs water and cod liver oil, walk where we liked, at our own risk, and George could carry firearms for self-defense. The director added that he had obtained permission to move the cubs to Mukamazi Game Reserve in Tanganyika, where, since it was not a national park, we should be able to stay on with them. He left it entirely to us whether to move them or not. The conditions referred to were that we immediately send cages to the area in which we were searching. If and when we found the cubs, come to a decision about moving them or leaving them where they were. If they were not moved, then we were to leave the park and expect no more exceptions to be made for us. If we decided for the move, we were to let the park warden know immediately. We were to make no kill without permission from the park warden, and were to keep him informed every other day about what was going on. We decided that we would not have time to collect the crates. In any case, we could not know whether or not they would be needed. As a result of camping out among wild animals for many years, I've become a light sleeper, and that night I woke to hear the distant engine of a car. Some moments later, the park warden arrived and told us to move at once into the cars, as a lion had taken a visitor from a camp near ours and was still prowling round. He asked if we had any morphia with us, as there was none in Serenera. The man had been badly mauled. Luckily, George had 2 ampules. So we gave the warden these and all our supply of sulfonamide. At first light, we heard a plane take off. Very early, we went to the scene of the incident. Our sporing revealed that 2 lions had come past our camp and gone along the track leading to the next camp and stopped abreast of it. The night was warm, so the men had not put up their mosquito nets and had placed the low camp beds in a row. They lay with their heads at the entrance of the tent, which they left open. One had placed a basin on a stand behind his head. The man next to him had the middle tent pole as a protection, but the third had nothing between him and the world outside. During the night, The farmer in the middle bed was woken by a low moaning sound and noticed that his neighbour's bed was empty and disarranged. He switched on a torch and 15 yards away saw a lion with his friend's head in its mouth. He roused the camp, and 2 African servants very courageously rushed towards the lion. One flung a panga at it. Possibly this hit the lion, for he dropped the man, bit viciously at the handle of the panga, and moved a short distance away. The man was quickly rescued. Meanwhile, the lion continued to circle the camp, and was only kept off by having a car driven towards him. The park wardens and their wives cared for the injured man until the plane was able to take off and fly him to Nairobi. Unfortunately, his wounds proved fatal, and he died on the operating table. This was the first fatal accident to take place in the Serengeti since it became a national park. That morning, 2 of the park wardens shot both lions. The larger one was found to have a septic wound in his shoulder, which no doubt was a serious handicap to his hunting activities. In such circumstances, any lion in any part of Africa will not hesitate to kill a human being. Early in the morning, we drove near to the cub's ravine and climbed the escarpment above it, where nearly a month ago we had seen the cubs. We walked along its crest for nearly 3 hours, calling repeatedly, but in vain. Then we came down into the next valley and walked back to the car. As we reached the top of a rise which led into the cub ravine, George grabbed me by the shoulder. There were all 3 cubs sitting by the cars waiting for us. They behaved in the most matter-of-fact manner, as though we had never left them. Jesper came to greet us, giving the soft moans with which Elsa always welcomed us. He allowed me to pat his head, and then sat and watched us as we went over to the other cubs. They went off as we approached and settled under a tree, but when we offered them cod liver oil and water, they came and lapped it up quickly. They were thin, but in fair condition. Jesper's wound was discharging a thin serum, which attracted flies, and which he licked repeatedly. He was very friendly and came close to us, but would not allow us to pull out the arrowhead. It was wonderful to see the cubs again, and as we watched them we discussed several puzzling things. Why had they turned up today? Or had they been in hiding when I searched the cub valley and been too frightened by the presence of the strange driver to come into the open? Though previously they had always taken cover during the hot hours of the day, now they stayed in the light shade of a tree while we lunched. When George went off to collect the 2nd car which he had left in the plane, this didn't disturb them, and for all the rest of that day they remained in the open. In fact, they seemed to be adopting the habits of the Serengeti lions. We had stored some of our kit beside our camp beds inside the cars, and the rest on the roof. Jesper inspected these objects, hoping perhaps to find his dinner, and even Gopa and little Elsa came close to us, but we had nothing for them but cod liver oil. We allowed them to drink as much of this as we thought good for them, and then they settled close to our car, and during the night we heard them playing. Jesper visited us several times, no doubt puzzled that we had not given him any meat. After weeks of anxiety, it was a tremendous relief to know that the release had proved a success, and that the cubs were in relatively good condition. The only worry was Jesper's wound and his dull coat. We could not consider moving the cubs again after all they had been through, nor did we want to remove Jesper separately if he could be operated on in the Serengeti. So we decided to use our week to get him into better condition and then try to make arrangements to have him operated on. This meant feeding the cubs. George therefore drove off to Serenera to get permission to feed the cubs. While he was away, I watched them dozing under a bush. George obtained permission to buy 2 goats at a village outside the park. He returned at 6 p.m. The moment he saw the meat, Jesper seized it and raced away with it. Gopa and little Elsa chased him, and there was a scrimmage. The 3 cubs sat, noses together, holding onto the carcass. Tempers grew hot, and there were growls and spittings. For an hour, the deadlock went on, and not one of them would give way. Then Gopa made a try to go off with the meat, but Jesper grabbed it instantly, and another deadlock ensued. With ears flattened and giving angry snarls, the brothers faced each other while little Elsa quietly gnawed away. Finally, Jesper and Gopa relaxed, and the three cubs ate amicably together. Later, Jesper leapt onto the roof of the car, where we had stored our surplus kit, and found a lot of things there to delight him. Cardboard boxes filled with bottles, my plant press, a rubber cushion, a folding armchair. Busily, he emptied boxes, clattering their contents onto the ground. He tried to get at the blotting paper inside the plant press, and when defeated, threw it overboard. He also ransacked the rest of our kit. When he had finished, he rested his head on his paws and blinked at us. His brother and sister had not ventured to join him. They went off to play on a fallen tree, where Jesper soon joined them. The three cubs prodded each other playfully for a while, and then disappeared into the ravine. Tomorrow, we should have to leave the cubs, and we could have been fairly happy about them had it not been for Jesper's wound. However little it seemed to encumber him at the moment, it had obviously weakened his condition and was a source of infection, as his dull coat proved. In combat, the skin might get torn, or the arrowhead packed deeper, and either of these possibilities might cause serious damage, which would ultimately impair his capacity to hunt. In the circumstances, the sooner he could be operated on, the better. We decided to leave as early as was possible the next morning, so that we could get permission to carry out the operation. When it was dark, Jesper came for his cod liver oil. There was not much left in the gallon tin we had opened 6 days ago, and I wanted to divide it equally among the cubs. When Jesper saw me holding the tin, he tried to seize it. I said, "No, Jesper, no," and looking puzzled and hurt, he at once turned away. After this, I poured the oil into three dishes. Gopa and little Elsa drank theirs up at once, but Jesper was offended and would not come near the dish I held out to him. I dared not put it on the ground, for then the others would have finished it off, so I tried my best to get into favour again. But Jesper looked stonily in the opposite direction and ignored me. We passed the evening watching the cubs licking each other and rolling about affectionately together behind the cars. They left about 11 p.m. This was the last we were to see of them, though at the time we expected to return soon with a vet. Later in the night, we heard some lions calling in a low voice to each other and hoped it might be our cubs hunting. Next morning, we left for Serronera, hoping to arrange facilities to operate on Jesper at once. These were denied. On our way through Arusha, we approached the director again. He advised us to appeal to the trustees, who were holding the next meeting in August. With a heavy heart, we left Tanganyika. We waited until the end of October to learn the trustees' decision. When it came, it was a refusal. Determined to find Jesper, we decided to return immediately to the Serengeti, although this meant that we should have to race against the rains and search for him under tourist conditions. In the northern frontier district, the rains had already started, and we had a lot of difficulty in getting our two Land Rovers and the Elsa lorry along the flooded road, which led to Tanganyika. When we reached the Serengeti, we found an overcast sky, which threatened to release floods at any moment. We camped at our former site. The plains were teeming with large herds of wildebeest and zebra, and there were many foals and calves amongst them. In the ravine, we found no trace of lion, but when we drove onto the Parkland Valley, we saw a pride of five at a zebra kill, and among them two young lions, one with a short blonde mane, and another with one equally short but darker. We remained there for 4 hours watching the pair, until we were quite sure that they were not Jesper and Gopa. In spite of the difficult conditions, we went every morning first to the ravine, crept up valleys, and into the hinterland beyond the escarpment, but we never saw a sign of the cubs. We covered about 100 miles a day. We struggled for months against the worst possible weather, wrecking our car, putting important work aside, and doing no good to our health, and all this under conditions which greatly reduced our chances of finding the cubs. So, when on the 22nd of February the director came to Serenera, I wrote to him repeating my plea to be allowed to sleep out, since this was our best hope of finding the cubs. He replied that it was not within his competence to give us such permission, but suggested that as a possible way of breaking the deadlock between the park authorities and ourselves, I could attend the March meeting of the trustees. It was all to no avail, so we found ourselves back where we had been for the last 9 months. Before I left, my attention was drawn to the fact that the Serengeti would be closed during the next rainy period, April and May, but that should we wish to come back in June, as ordinary visitors, there would be no objection. During the time that was left, we determined to concentrate our searches in the areas which were free of tsetse, and should it prove necessary, we would return in June and continue to look for Jesper. When the park warden returned from a safari, he told us that he had seen the lame young lion still in company with another lion, who was plainly providing him with food, since he could not hunt for himself. The park warden had shot two Tommies to help him out, but doubted if he would recover, and said he meant to keep an eye on him and put him out of misery if it seemed necessary. On hearing this, even though the warden had assured us that the lion could not be Jesper, as he had no wound or scar, we set off at once to find the injured animal. Within a few hundred yards of Narbi Hill were some rocks and a few trees which provided shade and made the spot an ideal lie-up for lions. From here, they could watch the surrounding plain, which was now teeming with game. We found the rocks occupied by two young lions. George had seen them before. Then one of them had been ill, but now both were in fine condition. They rubbed their heads affectionately against each other, just as our cubs always did. Nearby was a fully grown lioness. When we stopped the car to take a photograph of her, she rolled on her back with her four paws in the air and yawned lazily. Circling round Narbi Hill, we saw a pride of eight lions and stopped the car. Immediately, a young male rushed up and sat close looking at us. He was so like Jesper that we even wondered whether he might be our cub, but he showed no scar and his expression was different. All the same, we wanted to test him, but could not wait to do so because of the need to be back at Serenera by nightfall. Very early next morning, we set out to look for him again. The pride had only moved a short distance into the plain. They were dozing and too replete to bother about us, except for the young lion who came up, circled the car, and behaved in such a friendly manner that doubts again assailed us. Could he be Jesper? The pie dish would be the conclusive test. We held it out. The cub looked at it with complete indifference. By now, we had almost given up hope of finding the injured lion, though we were anxious to do so, to make quite certain that he was not Jesper. One day, we found him by a rain pool. His companion was with him, and not far away were two young lions with short ruffs. The four seemed to have formed a bachelor party. We hoped it was for the purpose of helping the sick lion. At our approach, he pulled himself up into a standing position, but carefully sat down again, for it obviously hurt him to put weight on the injured leg. His rump was withered. He was thin, and the expression of his eyes showed that he was in pain. A first glance had told us that he was not Jesper, but I was tormented by the idea that our cub might be in a similar state. We had not much time left before we should be forced to leave the Serengeti for 2 months. During our final days in the park, we drove non-stop from sunrise to dark, hoping that we might still get a sight of the cubs before we had to leave. We had spent 5 months in the Serengeti. We had searched every accessible place in which we thought the cubs might be. It had all been fruitless. On our last day, we were guided by vultures to a buffalo kill near to the place where previously We had seen the two lions that looked so like an older Jesper and Gopher. The dark lion